Throughout American history, the President and Congress have cooperated and clashed in their negotiations over the constitutional power to declare and wage war. The new book, Waging War, The Clash Between Presidents and Congress, 1776 to ISIS, by David Barron, looks back at over 200 years of American wars, from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror, and offers an account of this centuries-old power struggle, examining how presidents have found ways to go to war on their own terms without defying Congress and upsetting the country's fragile system of checks and balances in the process. David Barron is a United States Circuit Judge and the former acting Assistant Attorney General at the United States Department of Justice, serving in the Obama administration. An acting Assistant Attorney General, Barron had to address these basic questions about who controls the conduct of war and what checks and balances really mean, not just in the abstract, but in practice. We begin our conversation by him talking about how he came to look at this history of this country waging war.
Well, it really started when I was a professor, before I became a judge, in the 3 or 4 years after the attacks of 9/11, there were reports of a series of positions that the administration then in office was taking that the president, it was really for the president alone to make decisions about how to conduct the war on terror. And that view of things underlay a number of legal opinions that the administration had issued from the Justice Department concerning interrogation, detention, surveillance, and it, as you may recall, stoked up a lot of controversy. And it struck me at the time reading them that that was quite surprising to me if actually our history supported such a sweeping view. So I spent a number of years looking at it as sort of an academic perspective of whether there really was legal support for that. And that inevitably led me back to the early history of the country from the Revolutionary War on. But then I actually had the occasion of working in the Obama administration right from the beginning, in that same office, the Office of Legal Counsel and Justice Department, that had produced those opinions. And I was there for about a year and a half. And when I left, it really led me to want to write a book which was less a legal argument and more history of what had actually happened. What had presidents actually done? How had they handled situations when they were in war and they confronted pushback from Congress?
One of the fascinating things to me in reading the book is we never seem to be on completely firm ground as to how we do it, which you think over 200 plus years, we would have a better plan.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's either a feature of our system or it's a bug. And at different times in history, I think it's looked to some like a real problem that it's not clear as to how to behave, and then I think at other times, maybe sometimes after the fact and a controversy has passed, it seems maybe like a wise feature of the system that it's not particularly clear. Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, who's from upstate New York, as you may know, wrote a famous opinion in the Steele seizure case, and this was back in the 50s, and he likened this question of what was the president's power as commander-in-chief in the midst of a war when confronted with a check from Congress. He likened our history on that to Pharaoh's dreams, and they were as difficult to interpret that history as it was to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, but there may also have been wisdom in the founders setting up a system that had a certain degree of ambiguity and flexibility in it, both because if you clarified it in one direction, that might, in the moment, take away a degree of flexibility that both the Congress and the President might think was wise, even if it favored Congress. But if you clarified in the other direction, you risk the abuse of executive authority that's hard to rein in. And so the tension and the lack of clarity, in many ways, I found to be the most compelling part of the system, so long as the actors in it, both Congress and the President, are sensitive to the fact that they have to be wary of taking things too far.
So the question is, does the system work? Does the system ultimately work?
Yeah, and I think there's different ways to think about that. I mean, there's no doubt you could tell a history of the waging of war in the country in which there have been abuses. We look back on the internment of the Japanese, which was sanctioned by many of the legal institutions, both Congress, the President, and the court. And it'd be hard to say in that instance that it worked as one ideally would want it to work. But from a broader perspective, a sort of remarkable feature of it is if you look at what the framers were most worried about when the Constitution was being enacted, it was something that other countries have experienced, in which you really get a military dictatorship in which an executive branch leader in war becomes so all-powerful that the system can't contain him. It can't operate as a democratic system any longer. And for all the notable concerns that American foreign policy might raise in people's minds, as well as its successes, a feature of a now more than two-century democratic system is that we still have the idea of checks and balances, and we're still able to run it as a democratic system. And that, I think, is no small achievement when you compare it to the history of these things from a longer perspective.
How much of it depends on the relationship between that particular president and that particular Congress?
Yeah, I think it's, certainly if there is a real clash between the two of them and they can't find any way to work it out and they come from very different ideological places, that's when you have the sharpest clash. And that can go in both directions. It can be a Congress that wants to pursue war much more aggressively, as was the case in the Reconstruction period, where we had probably our greatest constitutional crisis over the power of the Commander-in-Chief between Andrew Johnson, who was impeached, and a Congress which was really trying to strip him in many ways of his authority as Commander-in-Chief even while he was in office. But it can, of course, go the other direction when a president is the one trying to push things more aggressively and Congress is trying to rein him in. And, of course, the controversy with Nixon and the use of various executive powers, both in the war itself and then in the surrounding use of national security surveillance powers, was also an example of that crisis, as was Truman seizing the steel mill. So there is definitely, when you have just very different visions of war fighting and executive power and the constitutional system as a whole, there is that potential. What I think is amazing, though, is given how many different iterations of presidents and Congresses we have had, and how many of them have been, you know, quite strongly in disagreement with one another. For the most part, although there have been tensions, those tensions have not really erupted into crises. And that's, I think, to me, the story that most emerged from my research and that I hope to tell in the book, which is presidents who have disagreed with Congresses and Congresses who have disagreed with presidents have seen the virtue of avoiding casting their positions in stark constitutional terms, it's my way or the highway, and have found ways to proceed that aren't always pretty, aren't always smooth, take a long time to work out, but leave enough room for each side so that a full-blown constitutional crisis doesn't come to a head.
Of course, you were part of the Obama administration, serving in the administration, and I'm curious as to, because you write about this, the president's efforts to close Guantanamo Bay and the detention center there. He looked to do it through a series of legislative actions. Congress obviously wanted to limit the ability to transfer detainees from Guantanamo to other places, including the United States. Give us a sense of how that, in a nutshell, puts this delicate balance in the spotlight.
Well, I think it just is a really good example of, for one thing, the way in which a sort of narrative, which your listeners may be familiar with, of what's known as the imperial presidency that Arthur Schlesinger coined in a famous book in the 70s, right at the sort of height of concern about the Vietnam War and Watergate, that narrative is that the president can do whatever he wants, and he's the threat. He's the more aggressive actor, and Congress tends to be passive. That turns out not always to have been true in our history, and the situation reflected with respect to detention is an example of that, where the president came into office suggesting he wanted to roll back a national security policy that was criticized for being aggressive, and Congress has passed legislation to restrict him from doing that. So it just points up that there's not any clear aggressor or non-aggressor that we can easily line up with the branches. It's a much more complicated situational history that we have in that regard. But I think it's also interesting that the way this plays out, you know, early in our history during the Revolutionary War, George Washington faced a situation not altogether different than this. They had captured one of the king's high officers, and an American, General Charles Warren, had been captured by the British. And Washington wanted to do a deal as quickly as he could. The Continental Congress was not so interested in that deal and really ordered Washington to hold the British officer, and to put him in some pretty bad treatment as retaliation for what the British had done. And Washington was really faced with a dilemma. Do I just disregard what the Continental Congress is telling me to do, or do I agree that I have to kind of follow their wishes? And in fact, at one point, the officer that he was holding wrote to Washington and said, you know, you're a dictator. You think I shouldn't be held this way. Why don't you put me in better quarters? And Washington, a really extraordinary letter to the captured prisoner, writes back to him and says, you know, I don't have the powers you suppose I have. It's not in my inclination to disregard an order from my Congress. But having said that, he then, on the backside, worked with the Continental Congress to find some discretion, and eventually Congress came around to Washington's way of thinking, and a deal was done. Now, whether that will happen in our current situation, we don't know, but there are certainly shades of that history playing out today.
Is it an unfair question if I ask you if you can imagine Donald Trump working with a Congress through the many issues that you look at in the book?
One of the privileges of being a federal judge is that that's the kind of question I really, I think, as you can understand, can't answer.
Yes.
But, you know, I think the fact that we are in a wartime footing, in a sense, today, and I think by most accounts will be, and this is a relatively unusual feature of American history, and in some sense tests the system that I'm describing in the book in a way that it hasn't quite been tested, because this is such a long and sustained period in which America is in a wartime footing. To some extent, the Cold War is like that, but this has a different feel to it, both because of the immediate threat to the homeland that's still present, and because of the sort of hot war aspects of this conflict that are going on, have been going on now for 15 years, and that many people think there's no clear end to it in sight. And that means a system that is ambiguous and has a lot of flexibility built into it, and that has many virtues for that fact, you know, a question arises, is that still a system that can function as well when it's under this kind of strain for as long as it has been and may continue to be?
The book is fascinating. It is entitled Waging War, The Clash Between Presidents and Congress, 1776 to ISIS, by David Barron, a United States Circuit Judge and the former Acting Assistant Attorney General at the United States Department of Justice, serving in the Obama administration. David Barron, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Joe.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Waging War, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.